It's like he used to be so cool, and now he's like,
dude,
Serena Williams is serving tea.
Shut See, up, See, the dude. Internet turns everyone into a loser.
Yeah.
No, I'm, dude, I like Ahmadina Jad's Twitter account. He's like, dude.
Because you like tea. You've dude, enjoyed tea.
Yeah, he's just tweeting about things like, do not even come at me with this Kobe stuff. It's LeBron, Jordan. Get out of this conversation.
Yeah, I just don't like him as a top. Like, he's all posting with correct opinions, like the Serena Williams thing and like the Kaepernick thing.
But we can find
those anywhere. Yeah, it's like you can find those from anyone. It's like you have a gift for, you know, stuff about the Holocaust, really knowing God, preventing immodesty. And
does
like
Duterte tweet?
I wish.
God, that would be amazing.
He doesn't need to tweet, dude.
Duterte
just unleashes just 140 character BOMOs
in
just
meme
like
form,
machine gun.
Too.
Duterte would be one of those accounts where people are like, Felix, I know you like following this guy, but have you seen some of the things he's done? And I'm like, oh, damn, another really funny account. I find out that it's a problematic guy. Damn it. Yeah. I don't even know he's president of the Philippines. I just think he's a funny dude that I follow.
I don't know. I think he'd be like a Michael Mason type of guy. Just a lot of stuff about how. About being a boss and living your most boss life and how religion is for the weak and how, you know, he still fucks even though he's 80 years old and all that.
My favorite thing about Duterte, and, you know, there are a lot of things to like, obviously, but is that
he just visited the Holocaust Memorial in Israel.
I bet that went great.
He said never again.
Unless I'm doing it.
Yeah.
But he's awesome because, like, he's, like, sort of hyper macho, but he's also, like, he had that thing where he's like, yeah, you know, I thought about being bisexual. It just came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
He's homosexual. Like, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, it's extra funny because he said that his policy is comparable to Hitler. Like, he said, like, I'm fighting crime with Hitler-like resolve.
Yep.
Like, but in Tagalog or whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, he doesn't attempt synthesis. He doesn't care.
No.
He doesn't care about consistency.
You know he's got a hot couch in the basement of the presidential mansion.
Oh,
no, Duterte isn't a hot couch
guy. It's the Philippines, though.
Everything is a hot couch in the Philippines.
Well, it's a hot country.
Yeah, it's extremely hot country.
Duterte is a different... He's a different type of Midwestern archetype. He's the do-my-wife guy. He's the guy...
Okay. I need to know more about this guy.
You know this guy.
Yeah,
the do-my-wife guy is a middle-aged...
Do my wife, please.
Incredibly, are they swingers? Or
no, sometimes. He's an incredibly tanned psycho. This guy's wife wears a leather skirt, and he'll like finger bang her in the bar. He'll do very uncomfortable things, like go up to younger guys at a gym. Maybe go up to like kids at a JV football game and be like, you guys want to know how to really make a woman come? And they're like 14, and they're like, what? Do my wife guy is incredibly tan. He only works out his arms and forearms somehow. He's like just anytime you're with him, he'll get drunk and start crying about something. He's just like, I just want to get home and do my freaking wife. That's his favorite thing, is just to be sexual as fuck with his beloved of 25 years. And he will never stop giving you uncomfortable advice about how to touch the clit. He will never stop trying to pipe his wife down in a semi-public space uncomfortably. He's just he's a purely passionate creature.
No, Duterte is really evil. In 2016, in a reference to an opponent's remark that his rise could be like that of Adolf Hitler, Duterte said he himself would be happy to slaughter drug addicts in a similar way to the Nazis' mass murder of Jews.
I mean, that's just a different turn of phrase over there. Like, you know, like Hitler is like a boss.
He did apologize for likening his war on drug dealers with the Holocaust. And then in June, he called God stupid.
Well, as a callback to our episode we did before this, many people are now saying the hot couch riff has defined a generation.
I've gotten so many messages from people who are like, I didn't know that this was my life until you guys described it that way.
Yeah. So many people are saying, I didn't know I was a hot couch guy until that episode. So it's like they're
coming out.
Yeah. We're reaching a level of self-awareness that, I think, as Andrew said, everyone, like when people talk and think back to the best years of their lives, those years were all dog shit and awful.
We played the probably the most important hot couch game of all time last night on stream. We played a Halo stream. It was very fun, but I think it conjured memories of being on hot couches for all of us. And we had just a 3-hour dialogue about the world of hot couches.
As I, it's Proust's Madeleine dipped in tea for our generation. It has conjured up a reverie that is sort of universally felt and acknowledged now, thanks to us. Thanks to you, Felix.
Well, thanks to Andrew. Thanks to Mike. And most thanks of to all my Great Lakes boys who also lived this reality.
And most of all, thanks to the hot couches themselves.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
For making it
They're
all
the
possible.
Real heroes.
You keep rolling around in eternity looking for that cool spot. You never find it. Let's change the guard at the tomb of the unknown hot couch guy.
Another throwback to our last weekend's episode. Not to clap myself on the back, it's not exactly the hardest prediction to make, but I feel very vindicated that John McCain's funeral played out exactly like I thought it would. In
it's
that.
Still going on, right? I didn't think it was over. They're going to fucking fill that asshole with helium and float him above the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade.
Well, he picked a bunch of religious patriotic songs and Danny Boy because he's a basic bitch.
Well, they did have to extend it because I caught a red eye and I went into the National Cathedral and I said, God, you epic son of a bitch. How did you take this man from us?
He's going to have the bagpipist that played Amazing Grace buried with him.
Did you see the front page of the New York Post?
Yeah, that rule.
Okay, it's Meghan McCain, like, crying in profile with her mouth open, and it just said the Meg. Meghan McCain takes a bite out of Trump at her father's funeral.
Aww.
And now, like, the Trump people are very upset about this. They're like, how dare you bring politics into your dad's funeral or whatever. But which I think is funny because she was attending the funeral with her big boy husband Ben Domino, who runs probably the most shameless pro-Trump propaganda site on the internet.
Yeah.
So, like, what did he make of all of this? Because, like, he probably just published an article, like, you know, slagging off his own wife as, like, you know, some sort of her impropriety for saying he was a great warrior and his country didn't have to be great again because it is great and John McCain's great. But
you guys remember, I had forgotten about this, but McCain Bloggette.
Oh, yes.
You didn't
yes.
know
this?
No. Oh, my God,
so
I do.
So she decided to be a, I don't know, like a youth representative to the millennials or something.
Yeah.
And she's during her father's campaign and she started like a blog called McCain Bloggette, and it did so poorly that his campaign manager barred her from commenting. Her dad fired her. That's basically her. She got
from
fired
blogging.
By her dad.
The most no-show, non-real job on earth.
That's the equivalent of like your parents showing up to the wing and saying, Madison, you're not making handbags anymore.
What? How do you... Like in 2008, the standard was so low too.
Yeah, there's no content basically, just a bunch of how dare you, sir, fucking dumbass blogs.
Yeah, the two types of blogs were, you know, as we detailed before, Prometheus's Warhammer, just a highly disturbed man from Colorado Springs who's 39 years old and writes meticulous rundowns of every model rocket he's ever built, and then blog posts that are like, all right, fuck-a-doodle-doo, you're going to put on your big boy pants, and here we go. Okay, fuckmeister, shitbird, you're going to fucking... Oh, you think it's all unicorns and rainbows? Well, my ass goblin is shitting on my fuck.
And she got fired.
Couldn't hack it. Basically by her dad. She commented on it in some interview much later in the New York Times, and there was just no self-awareness. She's like, yeah, I guess just people didn't want to hear from me.
Didn't take the hint, though.
She learned nothing, obviously.
Learned nothing, never will learn anything.
I don't want to spend too much time on John McCain's funeral because I think we've already put him in the ground.
I was still kind of glowing.
We put him in the ground last
weekend.
Because,
to be fair, it's like he was dying for years and it was just die already.
No,
it took so long.
Franco style.
But I mean, just two things. Like it this funeral, it's I've been going on all fucking week as this kind of national event. I've seen it on TV like all week long, and had to hear, you know, nightly news anchors who are, you know, again, objective journalists say things like a nation mourns our greatest hero or whatever.
Fucking Dana Bash said, because it started raining when they were bringing the casket into the cathedral, the angels are crying. An adult human being whose job is to write and talk about politics said that.
Dana Gash.
Something that you wouldn't tell a fucking 10-year-old. You'd be embarrassed to say that to a kid at a funeral for one of your family members.
The angels are crying because they're like, oh no, we have to spend time with this asshole now. sanctimonious prick.
If you said that to your kid.
It's a woke toddler sentiment. It's not right, something someone actually says. It's someone says.
But if you told that to a kid, the kid would say, don't patronize me.
Right. That isn't even woke toddler. Like, if someone made that post, it'd be like, oh, that's definitely real because that's stupid as fuck. A child would say that. This is the state
it's religion. Platitudinous hallmark dribble from a cynical piece of shit.
Yeah, it just meaningless. But hey, North Korea, what a weird country, right?
Right.
They worship their leaders as God.
The way they wacky
deify
Asians.
Their leaders, and then have these garment rending breakdowns when they die. It's like, wow, that is a sign of an unhealthy society.
Yeah, there is
at least they turn it into gymnastics and shit.
Yeah, imagine like Chris Eliza trying to do a backflip with Wolf Blitzer. Actually, I'd love to. They both like fucking smash their C7s. But there is like a form of Juche that only exists for people in Nova. And this is it. It's it. The most noble thing you can do is like repeatedly fail and just become an even bigger sanctimonious prick every year of your life.
I'm just imagining the entire like New York Times mastheads with ribbon dancers.
I imagine them all turning over like cards being shown from like a satellite, and it's just his face over all of the sea.
Oh yeah, yeah. In the
tens
bleachers.
Of thousands of lanyards, just all like in synchronized card turning to form a giant mosaic image of the heroic Senator John McCain,
a real American hero.
The last thing I'll say about the funeral is that as I expected it would be. It became sort of a national pageant that. It really didn't, again, like all the specifics about his life that we mentioned are completely irrelevant because this was a moment that really needed to serve a purpose for those people in that room, and they needed to advertise it to the rest of the country. And that purpose was, of course, Trump is the weird outlier.
Yes.
Trump must be shunned. He is the bad thing. And if only we could just go back to the way things were. A couple years ago, right. Everything would be okay again.
When Trump fell to Earth in a meteor and landed in the White House
and
hatched, and we just haven't been able to get him out of there.
And I'm thinking specifically about the moment, probably the most nauseating thing, everyone losing their shit over George W. Bush giving Michelle Obama a Werther's original during the funeral.
Dark times.
I mean, that was inedible. He gave her one of those nice, weed gummies or caramels or whatever to get through that fucking funeral. But everyone who was just like just creaming their pants over that moment and just like, oh, this is what we're missing as a country. The former first lady and the former like the guy who invaded Iraq and killed like 500,000 people, just assuring us that like they're still fun, they're still nice, they're not Trump.
You know, it says so much, though, doesn't it, that Cindy and Megan and their brother, who has yet to be named, Trump, whose grave personal offense to their family was saying their dad was a bad pilot, was made a big show of not being invited. But then George W. Bush, who called their sister and daughter an illegitimate child, who smeared her, made her the center of this very nasty primary race. Oh, come on down.
And
the important thing is you didn't insult the great big patriarch.
And even crazier, and I didn't say this last week, we mentioned the fact that Nixon had sabotaged the 68 peace negotiations that led to McCain spending an extra 4+ years in prison that he wouldn't have had to. But I forgot to mention is that one of the people who spoke at the fucking funeral was the actual guy who was facilitating Nixon's sabotaging of the 68 peace treaty negotiations by feeding information he was getting because he'd been hired as a consultant by the Johnson administration on the fucking talks, and he leaked all of that information to Nixon, who then used it to sabotage it. The guy who was the actual agent who made this motherfucker spend 4.5 years getting tortured in North Korea Henry motherfucking Kissinger,
North Vietnam.
He fucking spoke at the goddamn funeral. Like, it's one thing. Okay, he smears you as a guy with an illegitimate black child and owns you out of a presidential bid. That's bad. Keeping you in prison for 4.5 years, more directly responsible for you rotting away in jail than any other single person on earth. He gets on the fucking dais.
Well, a plucky Vietnamese missile operator and your own ability to pull back on the yoke than Henry Kissinger.
Yes, his own oafish inability to pilot a goddamn plane.
I just want to read here. This is just the last few paragraphs from Susan B. Glazer of The New Yorker wrote this up. Letter from Trump's Washington. John McCain's funeral was the biggest resistance meeting yet.
It's true. No, it is true, that though. Is that's you're 100% right.
That's true.
Two ex-presidents and one eloquent daughter teamed up to rebuke the...
Eloquent?
Yeah. To rebuke the pointedly...
The one word everyone has said about the woman who got fired by her dad for being a blogger.
Yeah.
Well, eloquent ass. Yeah. Mrs. Too Damn Eloquent.
Yeah, they sent a poet.
So I'm just going to read a little from this here. Of course, there were fulsome tributes to Senator McCain's bravery and courage in public service. Stark reminders of the torture he endured as a prisoner of war and of the policies he fought for and against in his many decades as a Republican politician from Arizona. But McCain knew that he would not be the headline from the grand service, whose many details he personally oversaw. This was to be no mere laying to rest of a Washington wise man, nor just another funeral of an elder statesman whose passing would be marked by flowery words about the end of an era. It was a meeting of the resistance, under vaulted ceilings and stained glass windows. This was made clear a few minutes into the 2.5 hour service. Oh, 2.5 hour
Jesus
service?
Christ.
Good Lord.
Fuck.
When McCain's daughter, Megan, weeping at times, called it a funeral for nothing less than the passing of American greatness that her Isha father Allah. Represented, and not the cheap rhetoric that now passes for this. I'm sorry. Again, Megan McCain and John McCain, they're like, they're rebuking Trump. The only thing they're rebuking Trump for is being mean to them in public.
Yeah.
They do not disagree with a single thing he's done in office.
And that is the thing that's most horrifying about this, because that headline is 100% correct. This was a reading of the resistance. These people were all doing this self-consciously to, as you said, create an image to the public that these are the good political people. This is the established political system. And then Trump is outside of it. He's a complete renegade. And they think people are going to see that and they're going to dislike Trump. And that just shows how horrifyingly unequipped these people are for the fucking world that they live in and how doomed they are in their pathetic attempts to ward off the worst of fascism. Because when a mere regular person sees that, they see a room full of people who passed NAFTA, went to war with Iraq, fucking bailed out Wall Street on the backs of the middle class after the 2008 collapse of the economy, all in one room. And they're all explicitly telling them that Trump isn't responsible for any of that. This isn't his. He has no stake in the current system that you all hate. You couldn't ask for a better advertisement for him to continue his fraudulent appeal as a renegade, as a radical, as someone outside of the status quo that will fight for you as a regular person against the establishment, because the establishment is telling you that that's the case.
Listen to
that. But they're so delusional, they think that they are liked. They think that people think that they're the good guys, even though Trump is only president, because no one liked them anymore.
Well, they also... just fundamentally, we'll never know the difference between nice and good.
The resistance is just the greatest word these people could ever use to describe themselves. Because what are you resistant? What act of resistance is it where you still sit in your couch for 5 hours in a row watching a Hulu original series called like Family? What resistance is it where you try to make a fucking meal prep service meal 3 nights a week, then you consider going to P.F. Chang's, where your life is exactly the same, but you feel worse. You feel worse because you have given yourself notifications for all your news services. Nothing in your life has actually changed, but you just read the news, and then, maybe you go to a rally that's themed like, we're all going to show up in our underwear because the emperor has no clothes. You do that once a year.
Right.
And this entire thing is about how it feels to you. It feels bad. And I thought about a post I saw where it was like, oh, you know, I'm sort of sick of all the lefty hot takes I've seen about, like, we don't remember how bad the Bush administration was. You know, if the country's on fire, I don't care who comes to put it out. And it's interesting because it's not to these people that the country was just as on fire under Bush. It's that somehow this feels worse than that. It feels worse than that because with Bush, there was, in their memory, in their hazy memory, there was more, there were more norms, there were more lines, hard lines, and people ran up against more invisible walls, and they're not there anymore. And that is the worst part to them, that they can, this is not a predictable season arc for them anymore.
And that resistance equals feeling better, because that's what they felt watching that funeral. They felt better, so they thought, this must be working. This must be helping.
It's the ultimate politicization of self-care. This is... These people want entire elections and political dynasties just based on, you know, if it makes them feel slightly better.
Right. I'm taking a bubble bath. It's basically smuggling secrets through Vichy France.
imagine telling like somebody who like fought in Israeli occupation. Oh, I'm also a resistor. Like, imagine that. It's fucking incredible.
Sorry, to the point about, if the house is on fire, I don't care who comes to put it out. To carry that further, like, America's on fire and everyone at that funeral rushed in to put it out, but they were literally just like using a fire hose that was blasting high test fuel onto the house.
Yeah, it's like burning. It's like that epic gif of that happened. The fire department was doing a test and they accidentally put fuel in the line and they sprayed it and it just exploded.
My country real good right now.
Yeah.
but to this other point about, you know, back to George W. Bush and Michelle Obama and their little candy moment and people who were like, look, I understand the Bush administration was an epic twat waffle fuck show. But, you know, God damn it, like, you know, Trump is worse. You know, not to give Trump and his administration too much credit, because, I mean, they are ghastly. And in terms of, I don't know, mainstreaming open racism, I think that's what people are mostly responding to. But I have to say, he has not done anything yet that touches how fucking evil George Bush and Dick Cheney was. I saw another tweet that was like, someone was like, can you name one American politician that's as awful as Donald Trump is? Easy, Dick Cheney. Done. That's not even close. And like, this is what they can't compute, is that like, Trump is a deeply venal person. He's a dumb shithead who doesn't believe in anything. He only cares about himself. And he essentially has no functioning superego and is just like unmoored from, all of these norms and or politeness or anything like that. He's a deeply gross, awful man. However, Kissinger, the guy who spoke at his funeral, Dick Cheney, unlike Trump, these guys take themselves extremely seriously. Mm-hmm. They take themselves extremely seriously and they live for another opportunity to kill millions and work their will over the world.
Well, Trump would do Trump.
He, I'm saying, he like, has if the potential.
If you gave him a switch, like if it was presented to him that easy, if there was a button that's like kill, you know, the combined number of bodies in, say, Afghanistan and Iraq, kill those and you can be president and have The Apprentice on. And you'll get the best rate. He pushes the button.
I don't for sure just, know that, because I think he lacks the kind of worldview that allows for that scale of violent ambition. Like, he's a petty bitch.
Well, that's what I said. If he could just press the button, he'd do it. He doesn't care.
He's too lazy.
He's too lazy to go through it. Although we'll see about that. I mean, the Iran thing is always on.
Yeah,
well,
Venezuela, we're probably, I mean,
that's
like,
another good
one. we're in this weird moment in history where we're sort of repeating parts of the 80s where we're reeling from two military embarrassments, and we're now, you notice this that the sort of hard neocons like Rubio are pushing this line like, it's a threat to national security, drug trafficking.
Yeah.
Which is, amidst the opiate crisis, is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
That's fucking amazing to still trot out that fucking 80s line. I mean, I guess it was, we were still selling drugs to ourselves in that time, too. But
yeah,
this
but
is even more explicit.
The tweak is coming from inside the house more than ever.
But we are speaking the language of a humiliated empire. And I'm really not going to be shocked if we hit Venezuela, and I'm not going to be shocked if the Trump administration racks up similar amounts of bodies.
But that's the thing.
That's a function of he doesn't have this neocon ideology. He'll just push the button because he likes to feel in charge.
Yeah, but he does keep losing interest. Like, we saw that, like, a little bit with Syria. Like, we saw, like, he doesn't have the follow-through.
He has no, he has no motivation or follow-through. He doesn't work. Like, whereas, like, a guy like Donald Rumsfeld, you know, he had a standing desk and he had an odometer that, like, clocked 10,000 steps a day. And he wrote, like, 100 memos a day being like, you know, can we get a status update on Iraq? How's it going? Like,
yeah,
like machine. These guys who are psychotically, like, the organization man dedicated to achieving their goals and ambitions. Which
this is not to say that Trump can't wreak havoc, but he does not have the ambition or dedication or really attention span for something of that.
I don't know. Okay, you have John Bolton has spent his entire life like figuring out how to flatter people that flatter and push people who are like above him. And for a guy who's been like training in bureaucracies, like pretty much, yeah, more than half his adult life at this point, he has just a fucking tomato can. What does he have to do to convince Trump to go to war? Be nice to him. That's it. Mm. He doesn't have to go through any real tricks. He just has to be like,
however,
I think you'd be the best at war, Mr. President.
However, for a guy like John Bolton, being nice to another human being is a Sisyphean task. That's almost impossible.
John Bolton is so bloodthirsty, he can even turn off that fucking psycho part of his brain. He can. That's how he stayed around this long, is he can smile to get what he wants.
But he probably also, you know, flew a little bit under the radar. And I could see Trump turning on him for saying he liked Wendy's spicy chicken sandwich more than McDonald's chicken nuggets.
That's my
He'd
hope.
Be right about that.
That's my hope.
It is better. Yeah. Superior.
That's my hope, is that there's just like John.
There's a nuggy fight.
Right. John Bolton was like, he said an unkind word about like John Tesh. And Trump was like, he's been very nice to me. You don't know what you've said.
The real favor they're doing is that Trump is beholden to the exact same awful corporate interests that undergird every crime that was in that fucking chapel. And he gets to be exculpated from it because everyone's convinced that everyone is fully on board with this strategy of trying to make him exotic, which just launders his responsibility for maintaining all the fucking policies that keep people miserable, so that people will be more likely to say, you know what, it hasn't happened yet, but it's because he hasn't had a chance to drain the swamp. So we got to give him 4 more years to drain the swamp.
Read a little bit more from the New Yorker here. McCain's grand funeral, the Obama advisor David Axelrod called it an exercise in civic communion, underscored a fact that is often lost about Washington these days. The city is much more bipartisan in some respects than it has ever been, more united than it may currently seem in its hatred of Donald Trump. Again, as Matt, like you said, that is his reelection.
Yeah.
That is his.
Everybody
like,
in Washington
just
hates me.
Just clip that and put it on a bumper sticker for Trump 2020, and don't be fucking surprised when he wins again.
Yep. Everyone in Washington who you hate and think has betrayed you and or doesn't care about you hates this man.
Communion.
That means everything bad that has happened in the last 4 years isn't his fault. It's their fault.
Communion. What a great word to use. Just, you know, it always slips. This is not ideology. This is not wanting a better life for anyone. This is just our religion is feeling better. Mm. We are taking the sacrament. We made a little cracker in the shape of a plane and we washed it down. We washed it down with Anheuser-Busch, the fortune that undergird this fucking shitty sanctimonious asshole's fortune. Here you go. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Grandfather who let me fly these fucking planes.
I am surprised at how deftly they've been able to kind of adapt Megan for PR purposes. Someone who everyone hated, and she's only going to win. She's only going to win after his death.
Well, because she is his legacy. She is the inheritor of his greatness, and she has been co-signed by everyone in that fucking chapel. One more quick thing, Obama. One thing,
I hate her with my life. She does not leave the lizard alone.
So another highlight from this moment of civic communion was when Obama, during his speech, said, "I never doubted that we were on the same team." It's like,
wow,
yeah.
Why do we even have a show? I mean, there's nothing to decode in politics. They just tell you. And I do love how this comes on the heel of us getting owned for our book.
Why did you run against him? Like, that's the thing. Like, we were on the same team. Then why did you run against him? Like, why do we even have elections? If you're all on the same team, Why don't you all just get together in a room, decide who's going to be president without us?
Yeah, and all this week we had our book was called Naive and Facile for suggesting that there's some common interest between the two political parties. And then the last fucking Democratic president says about the guy who he beat to become president while talking about how he was dangerous and he was in the mold of George W. Bush. He couldn't allow his type of politics to reign supreme. Just to tell you, yeah, we were all on the same team the whole time. And of course, they'll say, oh, he means the team of America. He means that we both wanted what's best for America. But that obviously can only extend so far down the economic line before it becomes incoherent, because some people benefit at the expense of others. And that has been the bipartisan movement of the American politics for the past 30 years, has been making sure that that group that benefits has been the very, very smallest economic elite. And the ones who are directly harmed and impoverished are everyone else. So that's when he says on the same team, it can't mean anything other than that small economic elite, because it's a fucking contest over resources and control. And people on the bottom have lost and lost and lost under both parties.
Just to round out this New Yorker piece. A few minutes after the service, when the talking and singing was over and the bipartisan establishment flowed back into the humid swamp outside the cathedral.
Oh, settle down.
I ran into Jeff Flake, McCain's fellow senator from Arizona. And like McCain, one of Trump's few remaining public critics among Republicans on Capitol Hill. He retired, by the way. He's not running for re-election.
Yeah, he's not running for re-election, and he's not opposing any of Trump's actual agenda.
The fever will break eventually, Flake said. It has to. It was an oddly optimistic thing to say at a funeral, and when he said it, it hardly sounded convincing. Oh, at least there's that. But I imagined that it was a prayer voiced silently by many of those in that room.
What is this fucking bullshit? Are we watching the Hallmark Channel?
It's Susan Glazer, Touched by an Angel. I thought back to the beginning of the service when the choir had sung the beautiful words of the Navy hymn. O Holy Spirit, who didst brood upon the chaos dark and rude, and bid its angry tumult cease and give for wild confusion. Peace, O hear us as we cry, thee for those in peril on the sea. I have heard those words at many funerals before. She's a funeral crasher. She goes to hook up with people in her desperate emotional state. But never did they seem to speak to the room in quite the same way.
Good fucking Lord. You know who else, by the way, said the exact same phrase, the fever has to break, about right-wing populism? Barack Obama, right after the Tea Party election. And then they just kind of waited and saw what happened and didn't change anything. And then, oh, no, it didn't break. And now they're like, no, it'll break. And it's like, well, yeah, like the fever breaks sometimes because it is, you know, it's defeated by the body's resources and you get better. Or you just fucking die. That's another way that a fever can break. And if you're just standing there as the supposed sort of, you know, physician for the body politic and just saying, well, wait and see, you got about a 50-50 chance that that's going to work.
We have about 104 fever right now. But when it finally shuts down our brain and heart, I think you'll find that our body's temperature will drop dramatically.
Yeah. Well, slap some more leeches on them.
Every time I have a fever, I try to, you know, have a sit down with it, sort of try to meet in the middle and be like, all right, what if you take out my gallbladder? You can have that. Let's make a grand bargain to retain my central nervous system, and you can have some of my organs.
Hey, you know what's another indication that this fever is definitely going to break soon? You know what's going to treat that fever? Getting Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court and giving Opus Dei a chokehold on our fucking laws for the next, I don't know, 100 years? Yeah, that'll break that fever when they, you know, literally, I don't know, outlaw all contraception and labor unions.
Then again, Brett Kavanaugh was one of the top-ranked carpool drivers in the nation.
Yeah.
I love that. How many articles were there that were like, Brett Kavanaugh wants to make all women who go to a clinic play Russian roulette? Oh, yeah? Well, that's actually true. But he took me to Gilbert and Sullivan once.
Well, it's weird. Like, everybody who has access to write about a Supreme Court nomination in a national newspaper happens to know this asshole because it's this incredibly tiny, incestuous group of elites. And they all have good things to say to each other. So, yeah, the right to privacy will be officially abolished, but your commute times are going to be unparalleled. You're going to get to work. The fucking carpool reins are going to be humming.
Yeah, I mean, it basically has come out, you know, Kavanaugh is going to be confirmed, barring something truly extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the other thing that people were like, you know, counting on, what's her, Susan Collins or whatever, that, you know, she was going to, because, you know, she was going to vote no to uphold Roe v. Wade. Well, it turns out Kavanaugh was on a list of judges that Susan Collins had essentially pre-approved.
Oops.
Courtesy of the Federalist Society.
Like so a she's credit already, card for a college freshman.
Yeah, exactly. You're pre-approved, Brett Kavanaugh. And, you know, I see people like Chuck Schumer, you know, being like, oh, we have to fight this confirmation. I would, honestly, if you're him, just say, like, we lost this one. Like, he's getting on the Supreme Court. I mean, like, what are they going to do?
Well, that's the thing, is that they play this game where they center their own importance, and they insist upon the need for their continued leadership within the party and control of the caucus and things like that by saying, well, we have the experience and the ability and the know-how to play the game, to do what needs to be done with parliamentary procedure to get the best outcomes. But then when they get steamrolled by something like a judicial nomination, when it really is just comes down to numbers and they can't marshal the numbers, then all of a sudden it's out of their hands. And they want to be both at once. They want to be these indispensable operators, but then they also want to never get blamed when the system coughs out this kind of result. And the thing is that at the end of the day, what matters is numbers, and even more than that is what matters is your willingness to ignore norms and do horse shit like that, which they've been willing to do. I mean, you saw fucking Amy Klobuchar rending her garments because the Democrats during Obama's term lifted the judicial filibuster, and she now is like, that's why they're doing this. That's why they're ramming through all these judges now, as if they needed the excuse to do that, as if having the ability to do it wasn't all the license they needed. The idea that they needed the Democrats to make some sort of first move before they could breach some imaginary line of decorum, it's not true. And they're the only ones playing by those rules. And now they're stuck in a situation where they can't really affect the outcome, but they have to keep giving people the impression that they have power over this system instead of just being totally useless cogs, all of whom should be replaced by people who don't suck so badly.
Another quick note about the New Yorker, where that, again, Touched by an Angel, heart-rending television program was just aired.
Touched by a Russian anti-aircraft missile.
So the New Yorker, I mean, this is their point of view. It should be noted that it just came out today that The New Yorker just booked Steve Bannon to be their headline speaker at the New Yorker Festival this year, which is like...
They're reviving Steve Bannon.
He has not been relevant even one whit since he got let go from the White House.
Well, from Breitbart after that, because he went back to Breitbart for a minute, and then they canned him because he was on record criticizing Trump over the Russia shit, which, by the way, is all it takes to make him now officially a resistance person, too, because he said that the Trump did do something wrong by talking to the Russians about the DNC hack. So that's all they really want at this point, is people to acknowledge that norms are being violated. They don't really care about the content of anyone's views. I mean, Jeff Flake, to talk about another one, was a fucking Tea Party guy in 2010 or when he 2012 when he won. He was one of that generation of frothing maniacs who just came through the gates. And now he's an elder statesman and moderate, you know, champion.
The New Yorker magazine is like putting the paddles on Steve Bannon's big blubbery chest, and then it's going to open up into some gaping maw like the Thing and take off both of their hands. But
I'd pay to see that.
You know, but like if you're David Remnick or whoever put together the New Yorker Festival, and they're like, ooh, we can get Steve Bannon, I can guarantee you what they're thinking. Like when they got criticism for like, why would you give this revolting shithead who's, again, an irrelevant figure, has nothing of any import to say or offer at all.
No longer has even any popular base.
No power, just like a big bloated blob.
Remember when he floated running for president right after he got let go from Breitbart? And it went nowhere. And then he went to Europe to try to whip up all the local Geert Wilders and Blort Vander racisms and just mostly ate shit. It's just been a collection of political impotence ever since.
I can guarantee you what these people are thinking when they get criticized for something like this. What they're thinking is, but what if he's on stage and we expose to the world that he is in fact a racist and an anti-Semite?
Whoa.
What if we get him to admit that on stage? You know, the best disinfectant is sunlight. And by, you know, giving him the headlining gig at the New Yorker Festival alongside you know, a dog on a therapist's couch and a Roz Chast cartoon. We are essentially, if everyone knows that he is indeed a white nationalist, then would not want to be in his shoes, or Trump's for that matter.
And they're always,
it's just that they're really late to the game and they don't know, like they're still operating on like a pre-internet news cycle or something, and they don't know that he's over.
Well, they also think that I'll own him with logic. I'll debate him and reveal him to be a fraud or whatever, which always overestimates these dorks' abilities rhetorically. They get fucking destroyed by guys like Bannon in any kind of adversarial interview.
Absolutely. Even though Bannon, absolutely, liberals cannot fight Bannon.
Even though Bannon is an absolute fucking moron.
Oh, total
like,
moron. Yeah.
Every time he's interviewed, he's the little Carmine of the far right. Every time he's interviewed, he's like, well, you know, it's actually like Emily Dickinson said, two in the bush is worth one great happy family. It's like, damn, really fucking damn. My man loves books.
Yeah. he's
Mr. Sun Tzu Machiavelli.
He's like, found the contradictions within kind of like prominent liberal thought, you know, like the hawkishness and, you know, the whole like identity over economics, and he's exploited them, and they literally don't know how to do that. So instead of, say, maybe bringing a left winger on who knows how to talk about those things, they're like, well, let's hear him out.
Yeah.
Well, in the New Yorker world, the only two political options are like, you know, whatever Republican is in power and, you know, fucking one of the Johns. That's it. One of the liberals named John with no H.
John 182.
Yeah.
John 420.
All right. Moving on. I have another op-ed piece. This is going in a different direction, but we're checking in on an old friend of the show, Donna Brazile. Do you guys remember when one of our favorite friends. Remember when we read her book with David Roth? That was one of my favorite episodes of a recent vintage. She has a beautiful mind and a way with words, and she's putting it on display right now for USA Today in an opinion piece titled Democrats Stripped My Superdelegate Superpowers.
Settle down.
She's so awesome because like the argument with the superdelegate thing, like the DNC line was like, oh, actually no, this is very normal. It's just like a way for seniority and blah blah blah. And actually it's like the same as a regular vote. Actually it's less, but she's like, I was mortal. They took it from me. Like, she rocks. I love her.
She goes, now I'm a notch above a coin toss. And then like the subhead is this. Holy rusted metal. The Democrats strip powers from superdelegates. I earned my place at this table. There's a reason we're called the party faithful.
I love that.
I earned my place by being the most incompetent single human being in the history of the DNC.
Well, and also her place is very much based on this consolidation of power at the top. Like, she's like, how dare they? I'm supposed to have like a completely unbalanced degree of power in an undemocratic way.
I help make sure that we lost the easiest election layup in history.
You do got to give it to her, though, because it's like the thing that annoys me is that fucking smarmy Democrat line where it's like, yeah, I may have a disproportionate vote share, but I'm representing millions that are never heard from. I am their voice. I represent everyone. I'm a humble servant of the people.
Yeah, yeah.
And Donna Brazile's like, what the fuck? I had seat check. I was here. Like, it just, at least she's just putting it out on the table. I appreciate that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and she's like fair, Dr. Manhattan of the Democrats.
She's fun.
Yeah. To be fair to Donna, I don't think it's fair to say, I don't think Donna is as incompetent as Debbie Washing Machine Schultz.
Oh, absolutely not.
That would be
absolutely
hard.
Yeah. I mean, not.
According to her self-justifying memoir, no.
Well, I believe everything in her self-justifying memoir, though.
100% buy it.
Yeah. So she goes here. She continues with this like Adam West Batman style of writing. Curses, superdelegate is vanquished. And then what does holy rusted metal refer to?
Oh, you don't remember that line? That's from Batman. Batman Forever. When it's a very awkward attempt to do a throwback reference to the 60s TV show where they used to say like, holy whatever, Batman. There's a scene where they're towards the end and they're going into, I think, the Riddler's den, and they see some rust, and they're on the thing, and it's raining, and Robin says, "Holy must rusted metal, Batman." And Batman goes, "What?" And you think, "Oh, it's like holy whatever." But it goes, "There's holes in the metal here," which is an awful pun. Yeah.
Holy rusted metal, Batman.
Huh?
The ground, it's all metal. It's full of holes, you know. Holy.
Oh.
Yeah. No, it's not from the original. It's okay. From the Batman and Robin.
So we've
established Batman Forever. God damn it. It's the third one. Why can't they just be 1, 2, 3? Fuck.
We've established Donna Brazile is a fan of the Joel Schumacher Batman films.
Okay. I like those nipples on the suit. I don't care.
Curses. Superdelegate is vanquished. I've had my wings clipped, my cape ripped, and my superpower stripped. My irresistible kung fu grip on the Democratic Party is being pried loose by well-meaning citizens who may yet endanger the very fountainhead of their freedom.
Oh, boy.
This is like weirdly, I mean, the word fountainhead aside, but like this is like a weirdly kind of fascistic language in terms of like, look, I am the only thing that is keeping, you know, my kung fu grip on the party is the only thing that keeps you safe.
I of course have not read this, but I'm assuming she's using irony. She's saying, actually, the more that I hear this, the more I'm assuming it's going to be like, oh, I actually, you know, it wasn't that powerful, but just like, I like my snacks.
I think that may be where it's going. Yeah. She says here, "You see, since time immemorial, we superdelegates have stood as the guardians and protectors of the secret machinations of the Democratic Party.
Keeping it
safe from outsiders and agitators, we were ever watchful, always ready to spring into action should unorthodoxy rear its ugly head. But now, a simple Democratic National Committee vote has effectively left us neutered, stripped of our awesome powers, left helpless and weak like Superman zonked by the kryptonite, Batman without his utility belt, or a hammerless Thor." She's loving these comic book references.
Yeah, holy shit. Donna, check out Preacher. Awesome comic book.
Okay, I don't actually read a lot of comic books.
I've been too busy.
She's a fake gamer girl.
I've been too busy running the Democratic Party by executive fiat along with other Politburo insiders. I mean, superdelegates. At least that's the way it's been explained to us. Last weekend, the DNC voted to essentially disenfranchise the superdelegates, the elected officials, activists, and leaders who go to the Democratic Convention as unpledged delegates, free to support whomever their conscience demands. Many strident voices blame superdelegates for the fact that Bernie Sanders didn't win the 2016 presidential nomination, even though Hillary Clinton won a clear majority of the elected delegates. In fact, neither their introduction in 1984 have superdelegates overturned the choice of elected delegates.
I know you had a bad day at work, but Jesus Christ, she's just bitching about office politics.
We're not there to circumvent the will of the voters. We're simply there to vote. Well, not anymore, we're not. According to the new rules, we superdelegates won't be able to vote on the first ballot at the convention or on any ballot unless there's a tie some or some other deadlock in the process. So we superdelegates are what now? Merely the mechanism you default to in case of a tie? Great. I fought for the Democratic Party my entire life, and now I'm one notch above a coin toss. So,
I hardly give a fuck about this. I think the superdelegate fight, talk about rearranging deck chairs, but, you know, it is one of those things like when Perez ran against Ellison and the line was like, well, they believe the same things. Okay, well, why the fuck did you run that guy? Okay, so if the superdelegates make no difference, why do they exist?
And why is it so horrible that she's having this power stripped if it's not meaningful, if it's never going to come into use,
yeah,
if it doesn't determine the outside? And of course, you know, this is obvious, but the real point of the superdelegates is not necessarily to sway the outcome at the end, but to influence the outcome along the way by padding the fucking delegate total of one of the candidates, which is what happened during the Clinton-Sanders thing. Every time they showed delegate counts, even though they were relatively close in terms of pledged delegates who were won in primaries and caucuses, Hillary had this giant hundreds and hundreds of delegate lead because they counted all of the superdelegates who had pledged to vote for her. So that's where the influence comes in. But also, there is no influence, but it's also an outrage that I don't have power anymore. Yeah. That isn't actually power.
I mean, she's using...
I only want this small little thing, but I'm furious that it's gone.
And she's using like the superhero language, yes, ironically, to be like, oh, you think I'm like Thor or Batman or, you know, one of your caped crusaders? Well, no, I'm really not. I'm just I just work for the party and want what's best for everyone, even though I don't really have that much power. But like you said, I'm really mad now that I don't have it anymore. I realize that many people have felt left out. Part of the reason is that they have not participated, worked, and fought to the same degree as many other people. A political party isn't some sort of event planner that's there to make you sure you have a fun time installing the candidate of your choice. It's an organization made up of flesh and blood people who have spilled endless blood, sweat, and tears.
Wait, I like that sentence. Spilled blood?
It's made up of flesh and blood people who have spilled tons of their own flesh and blood.
They're just leaky sacks.
They're not superheroes. They're blood bags. They're blood bags hooked up to the party. They got O positive, universal donor, just being hooked up and just bleeding their veins into the corpse of the Democratic Party. These people have literally devoted their lives to creating this organization to fulfill their dreams, to fulfill their dreams of the kind of country we're going to be. There is a reason they're called the Party Faithful. Yeah, because they believe in something they can't see and don't really know is real or not. In one of my tweets this week, I used Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards as an example. He has devoted his life to public service, both in uniform and in office. As governor since 2016, he expanded Medicaid to give health care to thousands of Louisianans. He wasn't given a seat at the table. He earned it. And the superdelegates aren't the infamous smoke-filled room full of old white men deciding the fate of everybody else. But let me tell you something. It was once close to being that. I know because I helped change it. As I said earlier this week, I've been those people outside shouting at the gate. I was with Jesse Jackson in 1984, an outsider, a troublemaker and believer in the Rainbow Coalition. We complained and we fought, and we worked like hell for years to get on the DNC.
She thinks the Rainbow Coalition was like the Weather Underground or something.
I do want to say, though, as the son of a prominent Jackson 88 supporter and... I think Angela Davis in 92 and 96. I'm trying to remember how my dad voted. But Jesse Jackson wins in 88. We're a far better country. Our show doesn't need to exist. I could have just joined my true call of pro gaming.
God knows how it would be.
He would have been. He was the best one out of that pile. 100%.
It was a pile, though.
Yeah.
Now that POC, women, and LGBTQ leaders have a significant say in the nomination process, suddenly the rules need to be changed.
Wait a minute, I thought they didn't have a say in the
Raj. She's saying it used to be like that, but yeah. I fought to make the superdelegate process more diverse.
She's saying the people who got into the DNC, they're more diverse, but now that they have a big say, she just said earlier that it doesn't matter. And now she's saying they have a powerful, what's the quote?
Now that they have a significant say.
So what is it? Is it meaningless? Is it not determinative? Or is it a significant say?
It's sort of a liminal state.
I mean, to be honest, like none of this is going to change anything anyway. It's just going to be a less formalized kind of whatever whip procedure happens behind closed doors.
Oh, yeah. No, totally.
Suddenly, the rules need to be changed, effectively eliminating their participation. Funny how that happens. Lucy moves the football again. My dear friend and co-author, Leia Daughtry, tweeted
this week. She has not read anything for anyone over the age of 18.
All of the people lumped together as superdelegates have made the DNC an organization that everyone can be proud of. I invite people to become more involved with it, not to try to make others less involved. No, like, isn't the whole thing about the superdelegate thing is that people want to be more involved, so they have to take away the power of these weird, unelected super Democrats?
Yeah. No, but that's the thing. She's inside of it, so she can only think in those terms. She can only think of who's in the DNC and how it's diverse. Not the idea that there are people outside of the actual literal party who want an influence in the way that the candidates are chosen in the party that they support. It's weird though, because the Democratic Party, it's not a real party in the traditional sense. So there's this weird inside outside thing, and she's clearly focused entirely on this incredibly small group of people on the inside of it. I mean, the idea that the diversity there is more important than the diversity of the people actually voting in these primaries, none of whom are in the Democratic Party, is absurd.
To some degree, this has been a perception problem. People seem to think that we superdelegates really did have some sort of superpowers. Maybe it was the super part of superdelegates that spooked them. They began to fear and distrust us. Optics. We've wound up being outcast and despised like those with superpowers in the X-Men universe.
All right, settle the fuck
down. That's it. That's, you got it,
Yes, Bernie Sanders is building giant sentinels with laser eyes to hunt down and destroy all the super delegates.
I believe the better comparison would be Muir Island.
I would love to see the sequel to Logan, Donna. Just, oh, man. Just
no, she says... She says, we've become outcast and despised like those with superpowers in the X-Men universe. I think, like I said, I don't actually read a lot of comics. Yes, you do.
You love comics, that's all you read. This is such
She's like, you know, some may think that we're actually like the Hellfire Club or maybe the cybernetic assassins, Omega Red.
Well, you know, a lot of
I don't read a lot of comics.
Well, you know, a lot
but
of
Jim Lee's run on X-Men was
Well, you know, a lot of these party outcasts, they think they're the good guys because they're so morally pure. But if you actually know the story, they're sort of like Rorschach. They're actually, you know, you get to meet them. They're a psycho. Like I said, I don't really like comics at all. I never have ever read one. This is such good, like, even when she's just in USA Today article form, she's still, like, pure Donna, because this is all comic book references, and she's like, yeah, I've literally never read one, ever. I don't know what the fuck they are.
We all have, like, a great deal of affection for this person. We don't want to be in charge of anything, but let's think of it this way. Wouldn't you like to hear 6,000 words about what Donna Brazile thinks of Rob Liefeld?
Yeah, oh my God.
100%.
What's with all those pouches?
let Donna write a Spawn reboot.
Yes.
Absolutely, yeah.
And like, like Todd McFarlane did on the HBO show, every episode begins with like her in a dark lit room turning around being like, how would you feel if you're the party you loved and worked for went to fucking hell? Went to fucking hell and was made an assassin for Satan himself. What if the party you loved came back to Earth and found that its wife had moved on? How would you feel? What would you do?
Out of all so many shitty Democrats, just soulless people, just fucking nothing, just dead glass eyes, just pure transaction, their whole fucking lives, everything they do is just a climber activity. They don't enjoy anything. And then you just have Donna, who's so wonderfully weird and like has like this,
and she was clearly under the impression they were all in it together.
Yeah,
which
it's
is shocking.
Heartbreaking. It's fucking heartbreaking. But Donna rocks. And
yeah,
I
Donna
mean
rules.
That fucking earnestly. I love Donna.
She closes it out by saying, well, I can still go to the convention as a superdelegate and do everything in my power to help Democrats win elections. I earned my place at this table. Hell, I helped build the table. So when you're sitting at it without me, please use coasters. I don't want any stains on it.
What?
You
what?
Rule. You fucking what? Rule. I love you.
To go from an extended comic book superhero metaphor to one about home decor at the end, that's an amazing... That's like a alpha move
rhetorically.
What does
that
rhetorically.
Mean, though? What do the coasters represent?
Comedy? I don't know. Not being nice?
What's the...
nominating
what
Joe
kind
Biden?
Of varnish is on the coffee table?
I don't know.
The ringed coffee stains on the table she built, that represents the Violator, played by John Leguizamo. Sorry, producer Chris is just... handing me this bit of breaking news.
I was going to say that.
Did you actually edit in some of that X-Men music? Okay. Coming up soon, September 21st, a free admission event in, where is this?
The Florida.
In Florida. So if you're in Florida, NSFW, Not Safe for Work Corporation, State College Foundation, Palin and Brazil. Bridging the political divide. Sarah Palin and Donna Brazile.
Yep.
The GOP's first female vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin, and the first African-American to head a presidential campaign, Donna Brazile, are political trailblazers known for speaking their minds. In this powerful conversation, two of the most respected women in American politics.
Totally.
Slow down. But I also like, no, this conversation will be insanely powerful.
They're going to have this.
I'm putting on Cerebro right now, and I'm feeling the vibrations coming off this conversation.
It's not even going to be a debate, though. It's just going to be this bizarre thing. Like, it's going to start out like maybe 10 minutes political, then it's going to be like, by hour or two, it's just going to be like, here's what it really means to be someone's aunt. Like, right. Fucking weird.
Donna's going to crack open a canned rosé and like, it's just they're very much a different variation of the same kind of loon.
Yeah.
Like they were the right person for their time, and they don't understand. They're not very cynical, so they don't understand that they are there for optical purposes.
It's gonna rule. Sarah Palin is gonna end up yelling about some guy who promised to buy Todd's truck and then backed out of it at the last minute.
Sarah Palin is
Donna's gonna be talking. She's just gonna recapitulate the plot of Sisterhood of a Traveling Pants, which she watched the night before in the hotel room. Yeah. It's gonna rip. There's gonna be a giant box of wine in the middle of the table.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah. I hope all the Palins are in the audience. Just
get into fights,
have another fight over some snowmobile bullshit. I love that family. We already talked about them, but it's like that is, I would max out my contribution to a Sarah Palin super PAC just because I want like Facebook bullshit to be the animating, the next political meta is at least I raise my kids.
Because you know they're going to be able, the bridging that divide means they're both going to come out hard against fake friends. They will both agree about, you know,
them,
those people, they're behind, they smile to your face, you turn your back, and then they just put the knife right in there. And Donna's like, oh, I know all about that.
Sarah Palin reminds me of, she's like all the women who watch Sons of Anarchy and are like, Gemma's fucking badass. That's her.
I think the political divide is going to be bridged when they both come together over their shared love of Alan Moore's run on Swamp Thing. I don't read comics, by the way.
By the way, this is not a one-off. This is part of some sort of cockamamie tour, because I was looking for the article to just bring it up, the first hit was something that happened like 4 or 5 months ago at the University of Houston. So they're fucking touring with this shit, which means people are coming out to, I mean, we would enjoy it, but if you're a regular person trying to understand the political moment and you went to this, what the fuck could you possibly take away from it? Like, I don't know. They came on stage and they started drinking really quickly, and then they were hollering about headphones. I didn't really understand it.
I need, if this comes anywhere on the Northeast, we're going. Like, I hope absolutely. You know that we're going.
But it does, I mean, I think we're back to this. There's some question as to whether or not we have gone past, like, you know, the stage of capitalist realism where there is, like, you know, no future or whatever. But, no, we're definitely stuck in a loop. Like, Steve Bannon is back. Sarah Palin is back. People are, like, nostalgic for, like, the Bushes. Like, there's no sense of a future. People mm-mm. can't envision anything past this moment. So much so that a few of them have gone literally backwards. Like, Sarah Palin is irrelevant. Steve Bannon are irrelevant. And they're trying to do, like, walk-ons from people who left the show, like, fucking 2 seasons ago.
We all need to get out of this loop, walk through the walls like Kitty Pryde, Shadowcat. All right, so that about does it for this week. Big news, though. We are leaving New York tomorrow.
I'm never coming back.
As you listen to this show, we will probably be on the road to our nation's capital. Tickets still available at Club 930 on Wednesday night in D.C. and then Thursday night in Baltimore. If you are in D.C. and Baltimore, please come out to see us. We would love to entertain you.
Andrew, I'm bringing my keyboard and mouse from my desktop setup with me, so I won't have any trouble like readjusting the keybinds. Sorry about the games last
night. My pitch
sort
of had a broader appeal than the plug you're doing,
Felix.
Dude,
can you fuck off? I'm trying to talk to my friends.
No, seriously, D.C. and Baltimore this week. Go to choppertraphouse.com. Tickets still available. And then the week after that, Philly and a whole bunch of other places. Portland, Maine, Boston, Rhode Island, Camden, Connecticut, and then Brooklyn, New York. Back at home, baby.
I am so excited for the New England part of the tour. I mean, it's clam chowder weather right now.
I think we've all agreed we need to go to at least one scowling fisherman's village.
Yeah. Oh, man. I would love for a guy in a cable net sweater to curse me. I just, you know, when it gets this hot, you know, Northeasterners, you guys know the sweltering sun, the marinated garbage. You just want a big chunky chowder in a bread bowl. Mm-hmm. Like, right now.
We're gonna do shots of chowdy out of bread cups.
Yeah.
And we're just gonna actually just eat it. That's how you do the shot.
I can't wait to read a book that drives me insane when we're in Maine.
You can't get that from here.
Stay away from that road.
It is going to be a good time. These shows are going to be wonderful. Please, if you are a New Englander, you know, wrestle yourself from the ancient curse from the town that you cannot leave. You know, roll your fish body out of bed.
Tell us about how you long for the sea. I love those stories.
I love it when you guys talk about that. I'll even read your scroll. I'll curse my family for eternity. It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
I may marry a lighthouse keeper.
We're all marrying lighthouse keepers on this tour. But the same one. We're all going to marry the same lighthouse keeper.
I would love to live in a lighthouse.
Yeah, a lot of people think the lighthouse keeper is ugly, but me and my cousin, we fucked one. She looked exactly like fucking Kate Upton. Awesome.
Till next time. Till we see you in D.C. and Baltimore. Bye.
Bye.